Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And guess what we're talking about this hour? The Winter Olympics. We have much to talk about. I've been pretty much glued to the Olympics, as I'm sure many of you are. There has been tragedy in the sport. The day of the Olympics, of course, will be looking. One of the issues this hour is whether or not athletes are going too fast and it will result in injuries and some serious ones. We'll look at some of the sports that will ask why they were added to the Olympics. There have been great moments, though. The figure skating, I think, is just gorgeous. And the Chinese won for the first time, getting their gold medal yesterday. We'll look at all of the sports, and we have some marvelous guests this hour. We have four guests. I think this is an all-time record. Rhonda and Chrissy really went to town yesterday, and they all have different perspectives. Joining us for the full hour is Professor Bob Meshkov. He's a professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutritional Sciences at San Diego State University. The fifth edition of his book, History and Philosophy of Sport and Physical Education from Ancient Civilizations to the Modern World, was just published. He's a member of the International Society of Olympic Historians. He's doing a great deal of research in Greece these days, and he has served as supervising professor at the International Olympic Academy in Olympia, Greece. Bob, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's indeed a delightful opportunity. Thank you very much for having me.
We're very happy to have you with us. Also joining us, the first part of the program, is Wanda Wakefield, Associate Professor of History at the College at Brockport, State University of New York. Wanda is an internationally licensed official for the sport of luge and an expert on the history of the sledding sport. She worked as Chief of Control for the luge at the 2002 Olympics and also for the 2009 Luge World Championships. Wanda, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be able to talk with you this morning.
Let me ask both of you, starting with you, Bob. Has there been a movement in winter sports particularly to make things faster, to add a little bit more danger to some of the sports?
That is a great question, and the response is absolutely. If I recall correctly, the International Olympic Committee some time ago thought that the younger generation was losing interest because the tried and true, kind of the staid program had not really been ambitiously expanded. And as a consequence, the edgy type of athletic endeavors and the adrenaline rush and the adrenaline junkie type of spectators, which I must admit I'm a fan of those, were not on the program. So as a consequence, they did decide to expand the program and put these, what I would call, very extreme, very, very fast and very risky types of athletic competitions in the Winter Games, kind of like NASCAR. Hundreds of millions of people apparently are really glued to the NASCAR circuit, and its speed, its adrenaline, and it is close quarters, and it's quite a thrill for the fans, but lots of angst, I suspect, for the athletes.
Oh, I would imagine. Watching some of those snowboarders particularly, but also the downhill skiers last night, I was looking. Nobody ever told me how fast they were going, but when the camera was going with them down the hill, I thought, oh my gosh, these people are just speeding down this hill. Really, really fast. How fast is it?
I suspect I was watching that we're going a bit over 100 kilometers an hour, sometimes up to 110.
Wow.
And that's pretty blinding speed.
Wow. And you also, Wanda, are a NASCAR expert, so tie that into to luge and some of the other extreme sports.
Well, I've been thinking about that this morning, as a matter of fact, trying to sort of make connections between Dale Earnhardt's catastrophe and the catastrophe on the luge track the other day.
Yes.
In the case of Earnhardt, there had been all sorts of talk before that Daytona 500 about requiring the drivers to have the head and neck device to stabilize their heads in high-speed crashes, but it hadn't been mandated. And then, of course, Earnhardt died from the injury that probably would have been prevented had he had a Hans device on. In the case of the luge, everybody knew going in that this was going to be a really fast track, and it was intentionally designed to be the fastest track in the world. From television's perspective, the men's start would look like it literally came out of the sky, and from television's perspective, that was going to make a beautiful show. What's interesting to me is, and I've been talking to people, that they didn't think about that finish and the way the finish curve was set up, and it didn't occur to anybody involved in the sport to ask whether or not that wall should have been built up, that they built up after the accident. But, you know, I mean, most of the athletes I had talked to before these Olympics began were looking forward to racing at Whistler. They thought it was going to be great fun to really challenge themselves at the extremely high speeds.
Yes, but Kumar Tashvili evidently did not. There's this element when he called his father shortly before and talked about how afraid he was. It was almost as though his instincts were telling him, I'm not ready to do this.
Yes, yes, and that's the tragedy. The tragedy is part of the way the Olympics operate. The IOC wants as many countries to participate as possible. And so there's this ongoing movement to have athletes compete in a whole variety of sports where they're not necessarily ready to compete.
Do you agree with that, Bob?
Absolutely. In fact, there is a story about a gentleman from Mexico who was born and raised there, but he lives in Europe, and he is, I believe, a member of old European aristocracy. He's 51, and he's participating in his fifth Olympic Games for Mexico. And he even said that he's not going to medal, he's not going to place. It's just something he does. And as Professor Wakefield had noted, I don't think he is really ready. But nonetheless, as she said, the IOC wants an awful lot of numbers and participants, and so there are people, again, I think there's a gentleman from Ghana who's going to be racing, and he just says, my goal is just not to finish dead last. Mm. And these people, I think, should not be there. Mm-hmm. And that's a personal opinion, just because of the expertise that's involved and the danger or the element of danger that they're going to face. Could make for some tragic consequences.
Yes. Wanda, tell me a little more about the luge. Has it been around for a long time, or is it fairly recent?
Well, you know, I mean, the luge is an ancient sport. Every kid who's ever, you know, had a hill in a snowstorm has done some sort of sliding on a hill. you know, it's just an ancient
fun.
Sport.
Right.
It began being competed in the late 19th century, and was added to the Olympic program in 1964. So it's been a part of the Olympic program since then. And during these decades, the sport has changed quite a bit in terms of the way the sled handles, the way tracks are designed. And so it's, you know, it's a sport for people who like going fast.
Very fast.
And a sport for people who really want to test themselves against the elements as well. But it's, like I said, it's a relatively old sport on the Olympic program.
Mm-hmm. You said, Bob, and I must say that although I close my eyes at times because they're going so fast, I kind of like to watch the snowboarding as well. I just think it's amazing what these young men and women are able to do. But I'm interested in what you said about the younger generation losing interest. Why would they lose interest? The downhill skiers are pretty phenomenal as well. The skaters are great. The hockey players are great. Why are we moving away from traditional sports? And do you see a time when those sports just won't be a part of the Olympics?
Great question. I think we're moving away from the traditional sports to some degree, but as you pointed out, I think the downhill will always be with us. Just because of the speed factor and the adrenaline, and it's always a great crowd pleaser. But the snowboarding, the half pipe, It seems to really have great appeal for what we used to call Generation X. I don't know what they are now. But it is a situation where it kind of evolved from skateboarding and into snowboarding. And so basically, at least out here in Southern California with some decent weather, you usually see half-pipe skateboarders all the time. And I know Sean White, who is the half-pipe champion, and they call him the Flying Tomato, is about 30 minutes north of the university. And he is a very accomplished skateboarder and does the half pipe and does pretty well on the snowboard half pipe as well. And it's just the aerials. I think it's the aesthetics. It's, boy, look at the big air, and I wonder what's waiting for us next.
Yes, I agree. I would also point out that with regard to the boarding disciplines, it's relatively cheaper to get involved in snowboarding than it is in alpine skiing. So you can get a lot more people involved, especially because they can do the transition from skateboarding to snowboarding.
Take a look at this in terms of inspecting all of these areas for safety. I know you were chief of control for the luge at the 2002 Olympics, Wanda. How do you determine, as somebody who is in control, the safety? What kind of examinations are made, not only of the luge track, but also of the downhill skiing, because the conditions have been on and off. People were constantly yesterday saying this track is very fast, the weather has not been good, et cetera, et cetera. They're canceling some races today because of the bad weather. Who makes that determination?
In luge, that determination is made by the race director, who's in overall charge of the competition. But the race director has the benefit of technical delegates, and those technical delegates are essentially responsible for working with the track crew to make sure the track is ready for racing. I'm not real familiar with how skiing operates, but I know they run four runners down the hill to see if, you know, basically the hill is skiable. And I would assume that there are technical experts who are on the hill during, you know, the hours before competition, checking for ice buildup or too much slush or, you know, the various things that could cause accidents.
Let's welcome some phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number for the whole hour, and our email is talk@wpr.org. We'll take our first call, Dick from Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Dick.
You already talked about what I was going to call about, not specifically, but why would there be a post on the luge course that any luger out of control could hit?
This is an excellent question.
You can imagine all kinds of bad things happening. Why was that post there? Does it need to be there? If so, why wasn't it padded so that the person might be about like being hit by a airbag in your car? You know, it hurts your face, but rare instances kills people, I guess. But like makes you think of that Carl Zock accident up in Fox Point on the bicycles. Remember a few years ago when it hit the ambulance?
Yes.
They had an emergency vehicle station on the course.
Wow. Here's what I know right now about the course. They hadn't had a problem with that design, except that people were complaining about the high speeds and the lesser skilled athletes. What I can tell you is, looking at that finishing curve, in retrospect, it's quite obviously dangerous. I don't know why they didn't think to put up the wall that they put up after the accident. Except that luge athletes, in my experience, almost never go out of the track. The working assumption in the track design is the track will throw you back into it rather than kick you out if you miss a curve. So in the ordinary course of events, like if you saw the crash that Armin Zeugler had during training, he crashed, he grabbed onto his sled, he stayed in the track, and he just came to a halt eventually. In this case, Nodar not only lost control of his sled, but he let go of the sled, which then sort of threw him out of the track, which is a very, very rare accident indeed.
Wanda, we thank you so much for your contribution today. Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
Wanda Wakefield, chief of control for the luge at the 2002 Olympics and for the 2009 Luge World Championships. She's associate professor of history at the college at Brockport State University of New York and is an internationally licensed official for the sport of luge. Bob is also staying with us. He's a professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutritional Sciences at San Diego State University and is author of History and Philosophy of Sport and Physical Education. He'll give us a historical perspective in a little while about looking at the safety of sports and sports that have been added and dropped from Olympics over its long history. Jim DeWeerd is going to join us in a moment. He's a retired ministry medical group doctor, and he is currently in Vancouver as part of the medical team. I think he's on skis or will be on ski shortly after he speaks with us. We'll meet those guests, and we're also going to talk with a reporter from the New York Times who is in Vancouver. Plus, take more of your phone calls. We got a busy hour. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Jim Wallace will join us. He has a new book, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. It's a heck of a book. All right, we continue our conversation, and Dr. Jim DeWeerd is joining us now, in addition to Bob. He is retired Ministry Medical Group doctor, currently part of the medical team for the Vancouver Olympic Games. Dr. DeWeerd, hello.
Good morning, Christy. How are you?
I'm fine. It's Kathleen. You were just speaking to Chrissy. It's fine. Are you close to be going on the hill? Where are you now?
Well, right now I'm in our medical support trailer, which is just at the base of the hill, and it's raining, unfortunately. So training is put off a little bit. So I'll be getting my gear and going uphill pretty shortly.
And what is your assignment? You actually are on the hill with the skiers, and if there's a problem, there you are. You help.
That's correct. My official title is a physician athlete care, and I'm entitled to the actually what I do is called field of play medical care. In addition to here in the trailer, I'm on the hill on skis with a rescue pack and with the ski patrol.
And how did you get that job?
Well, it was a combination of things. My experience is nearly 40 years as a ski patroller. And my work as an orthopedic surgeon and doing trauma care for many years. And back in 2000, I applied to work at the 2002 Winter Olympics and was chosen for that job. And since that time, I've done medical care for one of the World Cup events in Utah on a yearly basis. And 2 years ago, I met the people who were in charge of the venue medical care while I was in Utah, and they offered to have me come work with them.
I understand that the medical bag that you're carrying, so you must be quite an athlete yourself, weighs up to how much, 42 pounds?
It's a little over 40 pounds, yes.
Wow. Bob, is it common to have medical personnel, when you look at the history of the Olympics, on scene, on skis, right there to help? Has that always been true?
I think this was somewhat of a recent addition with regard to the on-site ski physicians, which are very welcome, but there's always been medical personnel at the venues, although probably back in the day not quite as many physicians and care providers as you would have liked. And I wondered if I could add just a quick footnote to what Professor Wakefield was saying and your caller with regard to the padding. Is that in the NFL and college football, the goalposts for decades were unpadded, and I can't imagine how many football players ran into those things and were somewhat maimed, and I can speak from experience on that particular issue. And I do know that in 1964, sadly, a luger from Britain was also killed during a practice run. So sadly, there is indeed a history, because there was also a downhill skier, an Australian, was also killed in a practice. back to the good doctor.
Yes. So, doctor, you're looking after the downhill skiers, other sports as well?
No, my my venue is all the snowboard competition.
Oh, it's a snowboard competition.
Snowboard competition, that's correct. I'm at Cypress Mountain, and the venues here are the Aerials and Moguls, which
Whoa.
Is called Freestyle. And then the other half of our venue is all the snowboard events, including the half pipe, the snowboard cross or border cross, a skier cross, and the snowboard giant slalom.
Woo! So you're right there involved with some of the more what we've been calling extreme sports. Would you call them that as well?
Well, these are things that you see on the X Games, but I guess I wouldn't at this point in time call them extreme sports because they really are quite well controlled and monitored. They don't do crazy things. They do go fast and they do go high. But they don't go nearly as fast as the downhill skiers do.
How fast do the downhill skiers go? I was asking that last night.
Oh, golly. 110 kilometers an hour, which is 70 to 80,
wow.
I think, is about as fast as they can go.
Wow.
And I know that, the snowboarders probably, because they do so many turns and jumps and high bank turns and things like that, their speed is controlled because they have to be maneuvering so many times during the race. So they're not going as fast, but the thing they have is they do get some altitude, and they're often in a bunch of people, so collisions can result in tumbling falls of multiple people at the same time.
Have you been busy the past few days? Have you had to attend to people?
A few minor injuries, thank goodness. Our role is to be prepared and be ready, but we would rather spend our whole day standing and watching, and in fact, that has been the case. There's some bumps and bruises and minor scrapes and things, and a couple people have had to be taken off the hill by the ski patrol and the toboggans, but they are mostly precautionary things, and there have been no serious injuries here.
Let's take a phone call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Paul from Clintonville. Hi, Paul.
Morning.
Hi.
Hello. I was curious, and I certainly don't mean to step on any toes here. Maybe an area that's a little sensitive, but we're talking about safety in the International Olympic Committee, and I was wondering if your guests know that the makeup of this committee, does it contain any either present athletes or former athletes that might be looking a little more strongly at that safety issue than, say, just business types or that kind of thing that are the monetary considerations?
Professor Metchnikoff, you want to take that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the president of the International Olympic Committee, Jacques Roga, is an orthopedic surgeon and a former Olympic athlete.
Hmm.
So I know that he has a particular interest, as they all do, in safety and the design of the venues to accomplish several things. As Professor Wakefield noted, can it be fast, but at the same time, will it be safe, and is it an appropriate venue for the competition to occur? But each Olympiad, it gets faster and they go higher. And I think that's what the people want, the fans want, and the IOC would like to go ahead and provide.
Thanks very much for your call. Doctor, let me ask you just a couple questions about the logistics here. When you're on top of the hill watching these events, how are you in communication? Are you just watching how people are doing, and if somebody's in trouble, you ski down to them, or you have walkie-talkies or something a little more sophisticated than that to take charge?
The communication issue is an integral part of the safety program here. Every physician and every ski patroller has a radio that is on a single channel that is all monitored by our venue medical supervisor, and he is an emergency room physician. And on course, there are about 12 sections on the course that are managed by course workers, and then we have about 8 positions on course. This is on the snowboard cross, where there are two ski patrollers at each position, and at every other position there's a physician. And when a racer goes down, One of the ski patrollers will report to the venue medical supervisor and the chief of patrol that a racer is down, and these folks are at the top of the hill at the start, and they get what's called a start stop or a course hold, and then the patrollers are given the go ahead to go out onto the course to evaluate the fallen person. Most times they get up and board away or ski away, but if that person needs help, then they will call for a toboggan, call for the other ski patroller, and if it's a serious injury, call for the physician. So radio communication is an integral and key part, something that we've met three times in the last year as a team to work on communication and work on calls on the hill.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the weather conditions there. We've been hearing that it's foggy and rainy and then it's snowy. Does it make it difficult to do snowboarding? And I'm trying to remember if there have been cancellations of events because of the changing weather.
Indeed, weather is a key factor, and it's really unfortunate that this weather that they're experiencing is the warmest weather in recorded Vancouver history.
Oh my, really?
Actually, that's what I've been told, and the last two winters have been tremendous with 10-foot snowfalls total, and right now there's almost nothing on the ground, so that all the snow for the venues has been brought into the area from Manning Park, which is east of here, and many helicopter trips, hundreds of thousands of helicopter trips back and forth between the higher mountains in the area to the venue to bring in snow. So the women's mogul finals were held in the rain, and it keeps this condition soft but slow. Fog is the thing that limits visibility, and it's we're in the clouds is where we are at times, and the jumpers can't see well, so they can't jump, and the boarders can't go fast because they can't see ahead of them very far. So, indeed, weather is a dilemma at this time.
What a shame, because usually, as you say, there's so much snow, and it is so gorgeous there, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, this happens in the winter in the mountains, and, you know, I've experienced rain in central British Columbia in the middle of February, too. So it does happen, and unfortunately the timing is such that it really makes the show difficult to put on for the world.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the medical staff, are doctors there from all over the world? Do athletes bring their own doctors?
Yes. Our team, which is in charge of running the medical care on the venue and on the race course, is nine physicians, many of whom are emergency room physicians and anesthesiologists, because airway management is so important for supporting life during serious injuries. And most of the major countries come with a medical entourage of physicians, therapists, chiropractors, and other medical managers that support the team.
Uh-huh. Professor Meshchikov, let me ask you a little bit about medical issues here. Have there always been, and I'm wondering how the medical community may have been attending to athletes long, long time ago. Were there different ways of treating them?
Oh, back in the day?
Back in the day, yes.
Back in the day, it's a great question. I am not too well-versed on treatment protocols, but there were, again, staffs, and as the good doctor had said, most of the national teams were self-contained, that they bought their own medical care with them because they weren't quite sure what they were going to find when they arrived in that host city. And so it was better to be prepared ahead of time. Having said that, the medical care has really gotten beyond excellent. I was at the Lake Placid Games, and while the athletes got great care, it's interesting because nobody had yet to mention, what about all the fans who slip, fall, and there's hundreds of thousands of them, get frostbite and whatever, but there was not a whole lot of health resources or medical resources for all the people in attendance there, but it Salt Lake when I was there in 2002, it was just fantastic. They had everything covered from fans to athletes from A to Z, and it was a terrific experience.
Let me ask both of you, starting with you, Dr. DeWeerd, how is it, what kind of mindset do athletes, knowing they're going into, or maybe they don't even think about it or never think about it, but seeing you there on the slope, knowing there are doctors there, knowing they've brought their own doctors, they're about to do a sport that may be very dangerous, what kind of mindset are they getting into to not even think about all of that, which I imagine you can't if you're about to do one of these twirly, whirly things in the air? The mind, talk about the mind a bit. Dr. DeWeerd, would you start?
Certainly. You know, I think the athletes are in a zone of their own at that time.
Right.
And they're not thinking at all about us, and we try to stay out and away and not visible because it gives everybody a chance to think about what if. I think that these athletes really have little fear at all of falling and crashing because they really have to be able to board and ski on the edge all the time in order to win at the international level. And so I think that they are very focused. They're very experienced athletes. They're the best in the world. And I think they're not thinking of anything but the race. They are visualizing the race. They're going over it in their mind. And they're thinking about every little detail and not about anything else but that.
Hmm. You agree with that, Professor Metchnikoff?
Yes, absolutely. There's in psychology, I know that we've utilized what's called mental rehearsal. And it is a situation where athletes keep rehearsing, whether it's going to be a half pipe, it's going to be a downhill, but they've been on the course so often that they mentally just about have known every bump, every turn, and when they do begin the race or the competition, they are so focused and the adrenaline is pumping, they have no fear because they have been training for years for this particular moment. And for a downhiller, you know, you're only talking a few minutes at the most, and for some people, it's less than a minute.
Isn't that something?
And so you lay it all on the line and pretty much ignore the risk factors.
Right. Let's take one.
I agree with that. I agree with that completely.
Let's take a call for both of you. Evelyn is calling from Nina. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have one comment. Who makes the decision to select the location like Vancouver? I thought their average temperature is a lot above freezing, and with all the rain they're having, isn't that normal?
Do you want to start, Dr. DeWeerd?
I'm not sure who does that, but, you know, the city applies more than probably 8 years in advance of the event, and the International Olympic Committee makes the selection based on site visits and data that the local Olympic Committee can provide based on past weather history and snowfalls and venue availabilities and things like that. But I think the International Olympic Committee obviously selected this spot because they were convinced that the show would go on based on past history of weather records.
Have there ever been other Olympics where weather was such a factor as it is in this Olympics, Bob?
Yes, 1964 is probably the pinnacle of the worst weather you can ever have for the Games. They were in Innsbruck. There was a terrible lack of snow. And so the entire Austrian army was mobilized, and they had to bring in snow. They had to bring in ice, and they also had to pack down the slopes, and then it rained for several days. And it was a situation that history dictated that at this point in the Alps, the weather was always supposed to be optimum, so you can't lose, so we're going to pick Innsbruck. And lo and behold, the weather did not cooperate, and it was a slushy mess.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful day on the slopes, Dr. DeWeerd.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you letting me participate.
Oh, we're delighted to have you here. He's a Stevens Point resident. Dr. DeWeerd grew up with a passion for skiing, and he is a retired ministry medical group doctor who is part of the medical team for the Vancouver Olympic Games, his second Olympic experience. He's on the snow patrol, and he practiced orthopedic and sports medicine for 24 years. That was fun. Joining us in just a moment, we'll be speaking with a freelance reporter for the New York Times, and Bob Metchnikoff is staying with us. And we'll welcome more of your phone calls. Feel free to call in 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Olympics this hour of the program. Email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Professor Bob Metchnikoff is with us. We are going to talk with a New York Times reporter who is in Vancouver in just a moment. I want to ask you about what you've seen so far as you've been watching these Olympics, Bob. Are you a fan of any particular events? Were you astounded by any of the performances that you've seen already?
Well, I'm a fan of just about anything that combines speed with a great deal of risk. So the downhill has always been a big favorite of mine. So I was really quite pleased to see Bodie Miller win a bronze medal, and I suspect he's going to win some more. Surprising, I'm still kind of waiting because the games are still in its early beginnings, but so many people seem to have discounted the American men's hockey team, and I think they're going to be overlooked, and I think at some point, maybe today, they're going to surprise a lot of people. And I hope they do quite well, even though they've got a lot of young talent, but they're all pros. So this will be something I'm going to like to watch. And then Shawnee Davis, who is another one of my favorites, had skated the 500 last night, but he dropped out and just said he wanted to concentrate on his specialties, which are the 1,000 and the 1,500. So I'm looking forward to his races. And there's Lindsey Vonn with her shin issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see how she steps up, and I have no doubt that she will. But I think Julia Mancuso is going to give her a run for the money this time.
Mm. How is it that some of these athletes, I know that some of the snowboarders had broken ribs and broken toes, and they were still carrying on. How serious is her injury, and isn't it fairly, I don't want to downplay it, but isn't it fairly normal for people to charge ahead, even though they may not be feeling great?
Yes. She's a warrior, and I have no doubt in my mind that she is going to put it all on the line. And once the race begins, that pain with the adrenaline and all the fans cheering, it just kind of melts away and subsides, and you won't really feel it again until you get down to the bottom. It's just the great thing that we have as our psyche is able to go ahead and mask that, if you will. So even though I think it's painful and most of us have injured our shins before, she's going to step up.
Right.
I think she is going to turn in a fantastic performance in alpine skiing.
And we need to talk about the women's hockey team, too, because many of the players are from Wisconsin.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward to that showdown between what seems to be inevitable these days, between the Canadians and the Americans with regard to supremacy in women's ice hockey. But I think the Russians are going to give them a run for their money, both of them, and the Germans.
And we can't ignore, even though the males in my household keep saying, you can't really judge this because there's so much variation in what happens. But, of course, many of us are glued to the absolute beauty and incredible physical effort it takes to be a figure skater.
Oh, boy, you've taken the words out of my mouth. And I think Johnny Weir is going to step up as well, even though he's not picked to finish in the medal round. I think that he's going to be right there in the mix of things. And, of course, all the drama that goes with the judging in figure skating, sadly, is still with us today. But I know that Evgeny Plushenko, the Russian champ, is going to be the most aesthetically and dramatically riveting performance that I think we're going to see in a long time, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. Let's take a call from Pat from Milwaukee. Hello, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling as a great supporter of Shawnee Davis. I was a speed skater for a few decades and competed in the Calgary Olympics.
Oh, really?
First time it was. Oh. Yeah, it was the first time it was shown as a sport, and it was considered an exhibition sport when it's its first year in, you know, on display. But I used to coach Shawnee Davis, and I don't mean by any means to claim any fame for where he is. He was a little kid, but he was you know, one of those great little, always having fun, big smile on his face, gave 100%. And I was really what he's doing this year, what he's been doing since you know, the last Olympics is incredible, setting world records constantly, and some of that being bantered by the press, because I don't think, you know, he's so not naive, but he has a seems to have a carefree idea with the media, but it seems like it could be detrimental, even, you know, mentally going into events and you're combating the global world of reporters. So I hope people really are supporting him and realize his a phenomenon in skating right now.
Well, and you should take some credit, because what happens in those early years, as we all know, the people who teach us are so important in our lives.
Oh, yeah, it was a pleasure. I mean, I was commuting from Milwaukee to Chicago, North Chicago, to coach him, and you know, it was a group of people, like young skaters and older skaters, in the summertime, and that became my forte. I liked. I started to dislike the cold, but summer training was fun because it was hot and sunny, and everyone was running around having fun.
Oh, I would imagine. Thank you for your call. Well, you're a big fan. You just said, Bob.
Yes, I am, and it's interesting that Shawnee Davis is not your conventional skater. He is pretty solitary, does his own thing, which is somewhat similar to the way Bodie Miller goes about his business.
Yeah.
As far as just kind of does his own thing. He's somewhat solitary, doesn't stay with the Olympic team. If I recall, in Torino, he was living in a trailer at the bottom of the ski hill by himself, and of course he did not finish as well as, in fact, he did not finish and did not medal, but I think he's put that past him. But Shawnee Davis, I have great admiration. He does not take support from his own federation, and although there's been an awful lot of press saying, well, if he did this and he did that, he might be better, I think he is going to do great things in this Olympiad. He has before, and he's just a great athlete to watch perform. He just pretty much makes the hairs on everybody's neck stand up, and people cheer and scream, and he's got a great persona on the ice.
Mm-hmm. Joanne Gerstner is joining our conversation now, too. She's a freelance reporter for the New York Times and is covering the Olympics for the New York Times. Joanne, thank you so much for joining our conversation this morning as we look at the Olympics. We were talking about those performers who stated themselves, who are kind of quiet, live in trailers, perhaps. It must be very hard, though, as a performer, and I have two questions for you, to remain away from the crowd. And the second question is, you know, how does the press make usually five or six people, a little bit more than that, these superstars? How does that process happen?
Well, wow. That's, if I could explain that, I could go to Las Vegas and translate. Basically, there's a few things. Someone like a Lindsey Vonn, let's be honest, is a very attractive woman. She's very articulate, and she's the best in the world. So, and she's also very media-friendly. So you combine all those things together, like an Apollo Ohno, same case. There are a lot of athletes that just seem kind of separate themselves from the pack. To get back to Bodie Miller, he's back with the U.S. Olympic team. He is no longer solitary, and I think he learned his lesson from the 2006 Olympics. And if you read any of the coverage that is in the media today about Bodie, he talks about that he went down the wrong path, that he was trying to inoculate himself from the pressure and the emotions of being the best in the world, and that his skiing became flat because he was not living in the moment. And he was saying what he did yesterday, he was very emotional, and he said that's why he skied well, because he allowed himself to feel it, to embrace it, and frankly, that comes with the maturity of knowing that no matter what happened, he'd be okay. He recently became a father in the last couple of years, and it sounds like that's kind of transformed his thinking on things.
Mm-hmm. It is something. Well, you answer that too, would you please? How do we make superstars of some people, Bob?
I would have to agree with your guest, is that if they are media friendly and they are good looking and they've done something absolutely sensational, it's pretty easy to make them a media star, especially if they're a hero or a heroine.
I always want there to be stars that are from other countries, though, too. And you don't get that. And I guess it's because we speak English here for the most part. But there are some stories that are quite, just as gripping. They just are not American stories. I wonder if we'll ever reach a stage where we embrace the world more than we do.
I think we do. I really think we do. It's changed dramatically in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, if you look at last night, Shannon Zhao,
yes,
the pair that won the skating last night, NBC sent a crew to China to talk to their coach. I don't know if you saw that piece before skating started, basically about how he sacrificed his entire life in the chase of first having himself hopefully become an Olympic champion, which did not work out, and now that how he's invested his life into the people he trains. And, you know, I would dare say maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that piece, especially from China. China
right.
is now opening itself to allow that type of stuff, and thankfully we're in a position to receive that information.
Well, you wouldn't have seen the Chinese winning gold in figure skating either.
No, or not much with gold and silver.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing thing.
What happened with that? The Russians always used to be number one in that sport.
Well, you got to remember, Russia is no longer Russia. Russia,
yeah.
You know, used to be like China and have this amazing sports machine and could call the best athletes from every corner of the Russian Empire, put them in a skating school from the age of five on, and literally pick from the cream of the crop. Well, I can tell you what's basically decimated Russia is, number one, their skating facilities are not what they used to be. The coaches are coming to the United States to train other athletes, and that's where the money is. And number three, their athletes might not stay in Russia. They might go to other countries, or they might pick other sports. As you know, tennis is huge in Russia. I think there's 10 women that are in the top 30 of the women's tennis tour. They're all Russian. Amazing athletes. Who's to say they might not have been figure skaters in a different life?
Right. Let's go to some more phone calls and to Peter next, joining us from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wish we weren't so obsessed with the danger aspect of this, the bad outcomes. I'm a former downhiller from back in the days when 80 miles an hour was about as fast as you could go. But there is no way that I would allow someone to suspend me over ice on one hand.
I see your point.
So much, there's so much beauty going on, and we go back over and over to the bad things that happen. And, well, that's part of the deal. When you become obsessed with the sport, you take the risk.
Bob.
Yes, I think he's pretty much taken the words right out of my mouth. When you become obsessed, you take the risks. And as I think I noted before in your program, Kathleen, that in Sochi, in Russia, which is the next Winter Games, I think that you're going to see things that are going to take your breath away that haven't even been invented yet for display in the Vancouver Winter Games.
Such as?
I don't know yet. My mind's still working at NASCAR speed. But I would imagine the artistry on the half pipe is going to be really over the top. And I would imagine with the technology and with the skis, is the downhill is going to be faster. It's like automobile racing. It's got to be faster. It's got to be more thrilling. Otherwise, the fan base and the interest starts to wane.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, just briefly, your assessment of the coverage so far, television coverage.
Well, I'm actually doing a story right now for the New York Times about that. And from what I can tell, a lot of people are quite unhappy with NBC.
Really?
And case in point, yesterday, the men's downhill was staged at about 3 o'clock Eastern, the final, and NBC didn't show it last night until 8 o'clock. And a lot of people wanted to see it live, and I don't think people object to seeing it again. Maybe you're at work, maybe you couldn't see it, but for those who do want to see it live, why not show it live? But they want to keep their little acorns, or like squirrels, they're gathering nuts, and they want to keep their nuts for prime time, and people are not happy. And I can tell you, for people that have been blessed enough who live in American cities along the Canadian border, there's been a real great sense of disappointment because the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which has done the Olympics for a long, long time and does a beautiful job, does not have the Olympic rights this year.
So
a lot of people had a dirty little secret. They were able to switch back and forth between the CBC and NBC. And frankly, most people skipped NBC altogether for the CBC because CBC went 24/7 with the Olympics. They'd show everything.
Right.
Now, there's nothing.
Aww.
So there's this an entity called the CTV, which I have been derisively told is the NBC of Canada. So people are not happy. So I've not detected a great fondness for NBC, and we'll see. With skating and some of the real marquee events coming, we'll see if they have an opportunity to redeem themselves.
Yeah, thanks, Joanne, so much. Bob, thank you for being with us for the whole hour. It was really a lot of fun. Joanne Gerstner, reporter for the New York Times covering the Olympics, and Bob with us for the hour, professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutritional Sciences at San Diego State University, and author of History and Philosophy of Sport and Physical Education from Ancient Civilizations to the Modern World. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and doing directing here today. And thanks to Chrissy Pierce for on-air production and for production as well. Thanks for all of your calls. We'll return following the news.